From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro. America has a problem with painkillers. It's not just that we consume the bulk of the global market, 80% of them. It's that we're killing ourselves, often accidentally. By one estimate from the Centers for Disease Control, somebody dies on painkillers every 19 minutes. Accidental overdoses are now a leading cause of accidental deaths in the U.S., surpassing car crashes. Given that painkillers serve a useful purpose, how do doctors, regulators, first responders, and everyday people manage these powerful drugs? We'll look at the issue from all angles and take your questions in this hour of Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro. How did America get so hooked on painkillers? Well, the stories vary. Many adults develop a problem after a surgery. Many teens find a parent's drugs in the medicine cabinet. Access is remarkably easy, despite attempts by doctors, pharmacists, and regulators to cut back on that access. And the appetite, once stoked, is so powerful, people who can't get painkillers legally often opt for heroin instead. There's no kidding ourselves. This is a problem other people have. The painkiller problem belongs to all of us, and so does the responsibility to solve it. We've got a number of people with us to talk about painkillers in America today, starting with Erin Marie Daly, journalist and author of Generation RX, a story of dope, death, and America's opiate crisis. Thank you for being here with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And on the phone, Anna Lemke, assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the Stanford University Medical Center. Thank you.
Sure.
And finally, last but not least, Hallam Gugelman, practicing emergency room physician and I guess a medical toxicology fellow at UCSF. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Erin Marie Daly, I thought we might start with you. What inspired you to get into this line of inquiry?
Well, I was working as a legal journalist, and so I was familiar with some of the early litigation involving the pharmaceutical company's mismarketing of opiates. My brother, Pat, who was 10 years younger than me, actually became addicted to painkillers when I was working as a journalist. He was in high school at the time, and his painkiller addiction quickly progressed to heroin. Now, my family and I actually weren't aware of the heroin abuse until after he passed away. So to our understanding, he was using painkillers. He started getting into trouble with the law. He was ordered into rehab as a result of his court case. He completed a 30-day inpatient program and was clean for 30 days, graduated, and passed away of a heroin overdose 2 weeks later in 2009. So when that happened to Pat, I really wanted to understand what had happened to him, but also what was happening on sort of a larger scale, and was shocked to find out that my brother's path was not unique. This is something that is happening to many young adults. In fact, in 2012, almost 3,000 young adults age 18 to 25 died of painkiller overdoses. So we're talking 8 deaths a day. And, you know, as a sister, this was shocking that my brother's path wasn't unique. But as a journalist, it was shocking as well to learn the scope of the problem.
So before your brother's death, you really had no idea how big this problem was?
I didn't. I mean, I was the person who had to Google OxyContin, you know, so I really didn't know. And I certainly didn't know of the link between opiate painkillers and heroin. I had no idea that painkillers were being abused. I didn't know that when abused, they produce essentially the same effects as heroin. And I also didn't know the price difference, which is that these pills can cost, upwards of $80 to $100 per pill, and heroin is about $5 to $10 a bag. So for addicts, if you look at it in economic terms, the progression from pills to heroin makes a lot of economic sense.
Dr. Gugelman, can you talk about this from the perspective of somebody who's seeing people come into the emergency room?
Yeah, Erin Marie's story is unfortunately something that I encountered very frequently during my training in Philadelphia. There are many, many people who are prescribed prescription opiates who take them for pain control, and then because of the nature of the medications, they become addicted and they receive more and more prescriptions, and ultimately either because of the medication or a combination of the medication with benzodiazepines or other drugs, or because they end up turning to heroin or a cheaper alternative to the prescription drugs, they succumb to these medications. And I have done a fair amount of research in this, and ultimately I really think this is predominantly an iatrogenic or hospital-created or prescriber-created epidemic. So I think
And why do you say that?
So there are many different reasons, and I know Erin Marie has done a lot of research into this, but there are many different reasons as to why these medications are being prescribed. They're being prescribed inappropriately in a lot of cases. So we have good evidence supporting prescription opiates for cancer-related pain or for acute pain, like fractures or acute surgical interventions. We don't have good evidence for these medications for non-cancer pain or for other pain situations. And pain is not increasing, the prescribing is increasing. And the result is that we have patients who are receiving more and more of these medications inappropriately. And, you know, as a physician, my creed is to do no harm. And by prescribing these medications, we are doing harm. So that's the issue, is that prescribers, all prescribers, have been prescribing these medications inappropriately. There's a big role of the pharmaceutical industry in pushing these medications as well, and I think that physicians and other prescribers have succumbed to that. But ultimately, the responsibility for inappropriate prescribing comes down to the prescriber.
Is that your sense of it, Erin Marie Daly, or is this a dish with many different chefs?
Yes, I agree with that statement. I think, you know, there's obviously many things that have gone into making this the epidemic that it is. I will say that in my research, the physicians that I spoke to were all very concerned about these, you know, what is the appropriate situation to prescribe these types of drugs for. You do have a subset of doctors, as was just mentioned, who really don't understand the risks involved with these types of drugs. And as was mentioned before as well, I think, you know, the role of Big Pharma in pushing these drugs, there was a massive marketing campaign that went on in the late 1990s and early 2000s. And this was brought by the pharmaceutical companies who were pushing their products, and they essentially told doctors that these drugs had very little risk of addiction and they maximized their potential benefits, where there's actually no research that these drugs over the long term to treat conditions, we're not talking about end of life care here. We're talking about conditions like backaches or toothaches. And this is something where these drugs have not been shown to be effective over time. And yet the pharmaceutical companies inform doctors, who then inform their patients that this was an appropriate use for the drugs. I also do think that there always seems to be a drug du jour. And, you know, when I was in high school, there's a 10-year generational gap there. When I was in high school, these drugs weren't around. When my brother was in high school, these drugs were what the kids were playing around with. And so I think they just happened to be the drug du jour.
Anna Lemke, regardless of what doctors are telling patients and the population in general, regardless of what regulators are telling the population in general, it seems like there are a lot of Americans who are hunting for a good buzz, many of them who think painkillers is the way to get that.
Well, I guess I would say I think it's a little more nuanced than that. I mean, I don't think that most people who end up addicted to prescription painkillers kind of went into it looking for a buzz. And I actually do think that, you know, the problem with the whole prescription opioids is that they actually do work for pain initially. And for some people, they even probably do work to control their pain longer term. But for most people, after you take them every day for, you know, let's say a month or more, people build up tolerance where they stop working. So then you need more of the same drug to get the same effect, and it escalates on like that. And I really think the process is insidious, both for the patients who become addicted and the doctors who prescribe them. I think it happens kind of in a subtle journey where all of a sudden they're using them not just for pain, but also maybe to relax themselves, to lift their mood, to be able to go out to a party because they were feeling anxious. And the doctors continue to prescribe them because they started out working, the patients were happy, their function improved, all of a sudden the dose is escalating, but they want to keep the patients happy for all kinds of reasons. So I guess I think it's important to say that you know, it's not like there are a bunch of awful doctors out there who are just pushing these pills, and it's not just a bunch of pharmaceutical companies, you know, telling them, oh, you need to prescribe these pills, and doctors, you know, like in an automaton-like fashion, you know, doing whatever they're told. I mean, certainly those factors have been very influential. I agree with what's been said. But I think in real time, as it plays out in a doctor's office with a patient that they're trying to take care of, it's much more subtle most of the time, and it's really difficult to tackle, even once you've recognized that there is a problem. Because once a patient's become physiologically dependent on opioids and their brain has adapted to seeing those opioids, coming off is extremely difficult and generates all kinds of psychological and psychiatric symptoms like irritability, dysphoria, insomnia, not to mention intensifies the pain. Part of the withdrawal phenomenon from opioids is extreme deep bone and muscle pain. So you've got patients who started out in pain, the opioids initially helped, then when you try to come off, they're even more pain. So it's a really vicious cycle.
It's interesting that you say that. I was talking with somebody from the Bay Area who did have back pain that brought her into the doctor's office, and she had two doctors, you know, one gently, one severely, warn her that there was going to come a time when she needed to wean off. And then, you know, when the time came, pushed her to do it, you know, basically flagged it. We know this is a problem, and now we want to make sure that you know that this is a potential problem and to head it off at the pass, as it were.
Right, you know, and that has been a huge sea change in the last, I would say, even in the last 2 years. And I think that's largely attributable to all of the bad press that doctors are getting, not to mention, obviously, our increasing awareness of the dangers of chronic opioids, including the overdose deaths, but not even just death, all kinds of terrible side effects like hypogonadism, you know, terrible intractable constipation, immunosuppression. So there is increasing awareness now, you know, like, all technology in medicine is a double-edged sword. When the new thing comes out, everybody thinks it's the greatest thing ever. You use it for a while, and then the problems reveal themselves. And that's what's happened with opioids. And I do think that the medical community is responding, albeit slowly, but we are responding. And one of the ways that folks are responding are, like the doctors that you're, the person you talk to, saying to people up front, hey, you know what, this is a medication that will help your pain in the short term, but it's not something to be used long term because it won't help in the long term, and it'll put you at risk for addiction and all kinds of other adverse health consequences. The other thing that people are doing now, too, which is a big change, is saying not only is this medication, these opioids, not going to work for you long term, but it will also potentially kill you if you take too much, and so therefore I'm going to give you Narcan when I give you this opioid prescription, and Narcan is essentially reverses opioid overdose. So that's also a big change that people are pushing toward. These are all good things in the business.
Dr. Gugelman, can you just help us here with a basic fact? Why do people die on painkillers?
So prescription opiates and opiates in general, that includes heroin and kind of the whole gamut, starting with opium and opium straw, causes a central respiratory depression. So in addition to the other issues that Dr. Lemke just brought up, and the hypogonadism, increased risk of falls, constipation, there's an immediate central respiratory depression that slows a person's respiratory rate. And at the same time, you're slowing down sort of their thought process so they don't realize that they're not breathing enough. So where a normal person would breathe anywhere from, you know, 9 to 12 times per minute, 9 being on the lower end, you see somebody coming into the emergency department with a respiratory rate of 2 or 3. And as a result, their blood oxygen level decreases very dangerously, and that is generally the cause of death. Also compounded by other drugs that are prescribed, especially benzodiazepines like Xanax or alprazolam, that sort of thing.
So
if
you,
I would add,
yes.
Pat's tragic death happened after he had been in rehab, and that's also a very common story. So when folks go in rehab, they stop taking opioids, and then their tolerance goes down. When they get discharged, they think they need to use the same dose they were using when they went into rehab in order to get the effects that they want, without realizing that now that they've been opioid naive for some period of time, their tolerance is decreased, they don't need as much, so they essentially accidentally overdose.
And I suppose despite doctors probably warning against this, a lot of people take alcohol when they are on painkillers, and that can lead a person to make a bad choice about how many pills to take and then to fall asleep.
Right. I think the real key with all of this is that the clinical appearance of somebody who's sleepy or asleep. And until you really get to the bottom of it and you see that their respiratory rate is slowed, then you really realize that they're in danger. The problem is that if you're at home and your spouse or your child is taking these medications for a legitimate or a prescribed reason, they'll go to bed. You know, they'll go to bed and they might take a couple extra pills, but to all intents and purposes, they look like they're asleep. And that's one of the real hard things with identifying it. I would add that, you know, California actually has done an amazing job in terms of not perpetuating this problem. It's one of the lower prescribing states, and there was a huge issue with Florida starting in 2007 where there were what was called pill mills, which we might discuss a little later, where doctors were handing out prescriptions for cash, and then pharmacies were dispensing medications for cash as well. And that has been a huge issue, and that actually is one of the glimmers of hope in this entire epidemic, is that Florida has really managed to start curbing their role in the epidemic over the course of the past 4 to 5 years now.
Erin Marie Daly, you know, it also seems like some folks have gotten the message in Washington, D.C. We're seeing a tougher attitude from the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, a tougher attitude from the FDA.
You could say that, yes, although I think that if you asked many people, they would say that this progress and these actions have come too slowly. But the most recent action that the DEA took was reclassifying hydrocodone to a Schedule 2 versus a Schedule 3. So this puts it into a more restricted class of drugs, and patients also won't be able to refill prescriptions on the phone. So this is something that I think will be helpful, definitely, in curbing some of the abuse of hydrocodone, which is, I believe, the most abused pharmaceutical. I could be wrong about that, but it's certainly one of the most prescribed. You know, I do want to mention, though, as well, that I think there's all of these measures that are coming into place. We have, you know, the prescription monitoring databases. We have these tighter controls coming down from the regulatory agencies. But the black market for these drugs is absolutely thriving. All of the kids that I interviewed for my book, when I asked them, you know, how easy is it to get these drugs? And every single one of them said, I could get you anything you want in 5 minutes. I could walk around the block. You know, so the kids that I was talking to, and, you know, the kids in my book are pretty much under the age of 25, got started on pills around 14, 15, progressed to heroin by 20. And for them, the drugs are incredibly easy to get. So I think we're starting to see a real dichotomy between those users and then maybe sort of the users that we were talking about before, which is people that are seeking help for legitimate medical conditions and being prescribed in a doctor's office.
I should also mention, like, the way we're talking now, it almost sounds like, okay, we've seen that there's a problem and now we're cracking down on it and it's a brand new day. But I have to say, as a journalist, I see headlines all the time about, you know, pill mill doctors, if you will, here in California getting slammed in the locker. And you have to think that, you know, if those are the doctors that were caught by the authorities, that there are other doctors out there here in California illegally dispensing pills for profit. And then in Washington, D.C., we have, you know, the Food and Drug Administration apparently ignoring cries from doctors and other health professionals about a new prescription drug. Zohidro.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems like there's okay. So we start to crack down on OxyContin, but then there are new drugs coming down the pike that just expand the problem. Dr. Gugelman, yeah.
Yeah, the fascinating thing to me about this is that the FDA approved Zohidro, which is an isolated hydrocodone product. So hydrocodone normally is paired with acetaminophen or Tylenol, which has its own problems associated with it. But they approved it in October of 2013, despite the fact that they had created and appointed a scientific advisory panel, which voted 11-2 against approving this drug. So the FDA, on the one hand, is cracking down and saying we're going to enforce some of these you know, pill mill laws and that sort of thing, but at the same time has now approved a new drug on the market where a new drug was not needed against its own recommendations, against its own advisory panel recommendations, which is just such a contradiction and such an oxymoron in terms of addressing the problem that it is very despairing for many of us.
Erin Marie Daly, do you want to guesstimate as to why this happened?
I think there is one answer to that question, and that's money and, you know, profits. We're talking about an $8 billion industry for painkillers. So these drugs are massively profitable for the companies that produce them. And the people that I interviewed for my book, particularly the parents who had lost children, had so much anger against the pharmaceutical industry and the agencies involved in this. What was just described is it's this wheel that keeps turning. And if you, it's like if you address one pill, another one is coming down the pipeline. So a lot of the parents that I talked to just felt like there was nothing being done. I mean, their children are dying. They don't see anything being done. And they're also, there's the element of shame and stigma that's associated with this. So a lot of these families feel like they have no support.
I'm wondering, Anna Lemke, if you can talk, even though you're not with Kaiser, about the fact that Kaiser, a major healthcare provider in California, has gotten serious about it, is at least trying to crack down on the problem within its system.
Yeah, so, you know, as you said, I'm not a Kaiser doc, but I really think Kaiser is way ahead of the curve compared to the rest of us, especially those of us working in fee-for-service hospitals. Because Kaiser has a capitated business model where you pay a lump fee to get service there, they're not a fee-for-service business. That means every time you go in, they don't make money. In fact, the more well you are and the more well you stay, the more money they make. So they are very interested in keeping you healthy, whereas, you know, in the rest of the healthcare world, the sicker you are, the more money the doctors make, the more money the clinics and the hospital makes, which is obviously totally twisted and backward. And so what Kaiser has been able to do because of their top-down model and their capitated fee-for-service system, at least in terms of my interactions with them and what I've observed visiting their pain clinics, is they've been able to say to people who clearly have opioid misuse problems, you know what? You're not benefiting from being on this. We're worried that you're addictive, and we're going to actually insist that you come off because that is the best care for you. And then they carefully titrate those people down and put them in these all-day programs where they learn things like meditation, they get physical therapy, they have group therapy, and they learn other ways to cope with pain. That could only happen at a place like Kaiser because, again, it's a kind of a unified system, a top-down system where they can say, you know, we're not going to let you carry on this way, and so, and this is what you have to do. If I do that with a patient of mine and they don't like that, they just go down the street and find a different doctor, and they'll just keep doing that till they find what they want if they're not truly interested in getting well by my definition of wellness.
Well, it's a complicated problem. We're talking about painkiller abuse in America. If you've got a story you want to share or a question for one of the people on our panel this morning, call us at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org. We're also reachable on Facebook and Twitter. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, and we're talking about painkiller use in America. We've got emails and phone calls coming in. Please feel free to join the conversation. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Call us at 866-733-6786. One listener writes in, I don't think that inappropriate prescribing is the major cause of addiction. I don't like to hear your panelists say in a dismissive tone that painkillers were prescribed for, quote, toothaches and backaches. Should painkillers only be prescribed for cancer patients and post-op? Toothaches can be relieved by just pulling the tooth, not so for back pain that can be crippling. Well, I think this listener is referring, Dr. Gugelman, to your comments earlier, so I want to let you have first crack at that.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a common argument that I definitely encounter. I don't think anybody on any of our panels or anybody who takes care of patients is flippant about pain, and pain is a true phenomenon that needs to be addressed. What we're talking about is the safety of pain modalities and how safe it is to prescribe or administer a certain medication in the context of pain. So if you have chronic cancer pain, we have very good evidence that opiates are safe for those and that they can be, you know, relatively safe, but they can actually be very effective for bone pain and other metastatic disease pains. When it comes to back pain, however, opiates are not the best modality. They are unsafe. They are addicting. They cause many, many other problems. And the real key is to try to address what the underlying problem is. So if you have a toothache and the underlying problem is dental caries and you need to have your tooth extracted, then you can address the underlying problem. The treatment is not to just administer more and more opiates. For back pain, the most common cause of back pain in this country, unfortunately, is, in fact, obesity. And prescribing an opiate for obesity is not actually addressing the problem. It is just addressing the symptom. And I think that's the real concern that I have, is that these medications are unsafe, and also they're not addressing the actual concern that would be really helping the patient.
I suppose it's also worth saying that like any other medication, it's the whole situation needs to be readdressed, reassessed by the practicing physician and the patient on a regular basis.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And I think part of the problem with medicine is that, you know, the amount of time that we spend with a patient is at a premium right now. And it is much, much easier as a physician or as a dentist, as a nurse practitioner, any prescriber, to write a prescription. Much easier, much quicker. But to sit down and speak to the patient and say, look, I understand that there are many factors involved in your chronic pain. There is anxiety, there's depression, there is obesity, there is remote injuries and neuropathies. Those are all the things that take many, many more minutes than you have assigned to that patient interaction. And the result is that after my shifts in the emergency department, I am here for hours speaking to patients so that I can try to actually get to the root of those problems. It's much harder and it's much, much easier to just write a prescription.
Professor Lemke, I'm wondering if you can speak to the fact that different people have different responses to painkillers. I have friends complain about them. I hate these. I can't wait to get off these. As soon as I can, I'm going to get off it. And then other friends are like, wow, that's fabulous. That just made my day. I wish I could keep on these forever. Do we understand why different people have those different physiological, psychiatric, or psychological, I should say, responses to pain?
Yeah, so that's an interesting issue, the enormous inter-individual variability to all kinds of psychotropic medication. If you can count opioids, it's also psychotropic, because for some people, they do enhance mood, and for others, they just don't. And by the way, even among my patients who have addiction, for example, my alcoholic patients in recovery, some of them will say, I knew from the first exposure to morphine that I was in trouble, and others will say, you know what, these doesn't really do much for me. And that's important to elucidate, because the patients for whom it doesn't have those kinds of psychologically beneficial effects, they probably are less likely to go down the road of misuse, abuse, and addiction. I guess, though, you know, just kind of responding to the caller's comment, too, you know, I think there, you know, you can't put the toothpaste back into the tube. Opioids for pain are here to stay. And I think what we need to do is figure out, you know, who are the people who benefit from them, even long-term, because there are people with chronic pain who do well long-term on opioids and manage them responsibly, don't escalate their doses, and don't get addicted to them. And I think that's really important to say that. It's not that they're universally bad or that everybody will get addicted. You know, like with the euphorogenic effects, there's enormous inter-individual variability in terms of who will develop the disease of addiction, and that's genetic and has all the other kinds of factors related to it. So, you know, what we need to do as a profession and as a society is, you know, obviously protect our youth from medications that will harm them, protect people who are prone to addiction from becoming addicted, provide treatments for addicted, but also acknowledge that these medications are out there and they do help some people tremendously with their pain, even non-cancer chronic pain patients. And, you know, how do we use them responsibly?
Erin Marie Daly, I'm wondering, you know, as you've just heard Professor Lemke say, the toothpaste is out of the tube. This problem has been going on for years now, and many of us know people who have died because of this. I'm wondering if the memo is out to teenagers in America, if you think that kids are starting to understand that they are playing with fire when they open that medicine cabinet.
You know, I don't know that they are getting that message. I think you have to also take into account the fact that we, for whatever reason, have become a pill-oriented society. And so, you know, I want to be clear. I believe that there is a time and a place for opioids. And I think what we need to understand is that because of this overabundance of opioids that are in our cabinets, on the black market, that are readily available, there has been a resurgence in the abuse of heroin. And that's what's happening to these young kids. So, you know, I often get asked, why do you want, you know, these drugs to be taken off the market? Why are you against these drugs? And I am absolutely not. My father died of cancer when I was 19. He suffered greatly. There's no way that I would ever want anyone to be in unnecessary pain. I think it's difficult because pain is subjective. And, you know, I think that most of the doctors that I spoke with really wanted to do what was in the best interest of their patients. I think the answer is that we all need to become more educated about the real risks and benefits of these drugs. Now, that's on the part of maybe sort of the older generation. In terms of the kids, I don't think the kids really know what they're playing around with. All of the kids that I interviewed for the book said that the pills were just kind of lying around the house, and they saw that their parents took the pills, oftentimes for chronic conditions, and that their parents seemed to feel better. So they got into them that way. It also
seems to fall back on the parents then. Again, though, the adults are responsible for making sure those pills aren't readily available and for having the conversation with their kids about what they are.
I think the only way to combat this issue is to talk about it and to be open and honest about it. I think kids are starting to get the message, but they don't understand fully, as I didn't when I started researching the book, that the transition from painkillers to heroin is much more seamless than you would expect. All of the kids that I talked to said, I was the kid who said I would never do drugs. I never thought I'd put a needle in my arm. And they all end up on that path as the result of painkillers.
Let's go now to the phones and Martin in San Jose.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
Well, it's not a question. It's a comment. I've got a condition called restless leg syndrome, and it's not pain, but it's, for me, when it kicks in, it feels like I'm trying to hold my breath, but I can't, and I have to take a breath. But instead of taking a breath, it's that I have to move my legs, and it kicks in when I'm trying to sleep and keeps me from sleeping, and it's miserable, absolutely miserable. And with the culture of sensationalism and the way the regulatory agencies are, physicians appear to have become so afraid that they're no longer concerned primarily for their patients. They're concerned for themselves being labeled as an overprescriber. And the result of that is that I absolutely need opioids. They're the only thing that's worked. I've been on six or seven, maybe a dozen other medications. I can't tell for sure. But nothing works reliably and as perfectly as opioids do. And I haven't escalated. I'm not addicted. Sometimes I forget to take them, and I have to kick myself and get up and take them. But it's the only thing that works, and it's put me in a position where I'm viewed with distrust and suspicion, and I'm viewed as a problem. One physician even misdocumented an encounter I had and made me look like an opiate-seeking bully.
Martin, are you working, it sounds like, with more than one doctor? Have you
I'm
found a doctor you can
system,
work with?
So yeah. my primary Kaiser. Care doctor referred me to a neurologist, and that was the neurologist who, out of fear, distorted what was going on. And at one point, she said, I'll only prescribe opioids as a last response. And after three or four visits over the course of a couple months with me just suffering, I said, how much longer am I going to have to suffer? She just shrugged her shoulders.
Well, it's a very disturbing story. Dr. Gugelman, it does seem as if, you know, Martin has gotten caught in the crosshairs here. Kaiser doctors trying to do the responsible thing, but not looking at Martin as an individual case and his specific needs.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Martin, I'm sorry. It sounds like you really are in quite a conundrum. This is where we're really in kind of no man's land. You know, I've personally looked through the body of literature that supports using opiates for restless leg syndrome, and there's not a lot of evidence there, but you sound like one of the cases where you seem to be taking them responsibly, and you don't seem to be escalating your dose. And I think the concern that I have here is that on the other side, as a prescriber, I know that doctors are now more concerned about this and know that there is more regulatory oversight. That absolutely does not mean that you can't prescribe these medications. So, for example, I encounter on a daily basis patients who have acute and other pain conditions, and I will discuss with them the merits and the benefits of giving them opiates, and I prescribe them opiates as well. And I think the concern that I have here is that there's now a backlash against the patient and a backlash.
Absolutely.
That is a concern that is misinterpreting what the actual role is of these medications.
And well,
the real, I think the real concern also is that, you know, the very unfortunate situation that patients like Martin will end up in is that you can't find anybody who can prescribe it, and that really will lead to people buying the medications in the streets. And I think, you know, Martin, I apologize. I think this is a situation of misinformation and a lack of information on the part of the medical community about your condition and about how to best treat it and how to treat it safely.
Martin, does that kind of address...
The physician's doing the responsible thing. I think the responsible thing is to consider the patient's needs first.
So let me just say that you know,
Lemke,
patients
yes.
are caught in the crosshairs, but doctors are caught in the crosshairs too. In the 1990s, the physicians and other healthcare providers were regularly sued for not adequately addressing patients' pain. Now we're in the 2014s, and I get asked frequently to be an expert witness on cases where doctors are being sued for overprescribing. So of course they're terrified.
Martin, thank you so much. I do want to give room to some other calls, but I sympathize with your situation and thank you for sharing it with us. Marla in Walnut Creek.
Hi, thank you for having me. I am a professional working woman, and listening to the last two callers can relate. The funny thing is I had my children talking to me about my addiction rather than me speaking with them about my addiction. It started, I would say, in 2010 as a prescription for severe menstrual cramps. And I had a doctor who would prescribe me 180 pills a month without having to be seen in the office for 3 years. And eventually it got to a point where taking my 9 prescribed pills a day, you know, at the beginning it felt good and it helped relieve the pain, but then it didn't feel good, but I had the restless leg syndrome, couldn't sleep, was counting the hours until my next dose, found it very difficult to get through the day, and knew I had a doctor that would simply call in another prescription. And it got to the point where I had a prescription at Target, I had a prescription at CVS, I had a prescription at Walgreens, and due to recent legislation, those pharmacies, thank goodness, started speaking to each other and telling me, you've already picked up your prescription, because now I needed them just to get through the day. And I also felt like I was somewhat treated like, well, I was an addict, but I'm a professional working woman, and I had meltdowns at Target where I had to say to them, I have 2-carat diamonds in my ear and designer shoes on. I need this or I'm going to be sick right here in front of your pharmacy counter if you don't give them to me. And the pharmacist looking at me like, you know, this woman is mad. And I said, I'm not mad. I'm addicted and I'm going to be sick. And finally, when I started counting them, playing with them, wondering when I was going to run out, I said, this is enough. My kids said they were going to report my doctor. And I told my office I needed a couple of days off, and I went to my doctor, the same doctor, I probably should have gone to somebody else, and said, I need to get off of these. And he said, okay, you're not going to call me anymore. And so he was, even though I told him I was wanting to get up, he was making me promise not to call him or else he'd call him in again.
Oh, my goodness. Marla, I want to thank you for sharing your story, but I also want to keep the conversation going. Professor Lemke, we mentioned a little bit earlier here that the state is now tracking drugs to keep an eye on doctors like the one Marla is describing, who's just handing out prescription painkillers as if they're candies.
Yeah, so this is one of the great innovations across the nation is these prescription drug monitoring systems where now physicians and other healthcare providers and pharmacists can gain access to all of the controlled substances, including prescription opioids that a patient receives from all the different prescribers and facilities. And that's just been hugely helpful in terms of allowing us to know exactly how many prescriptions patients are getting, what they're taking, if they're going to multiple doctors, multiple pharmacies. Because without that knowledge, you know, it was difficult for us to be able to identify people who were taking too much or had possibly become addicted, as this woman prescribed progressively and insidiously, as most people in her position do, kind of catching themselves unawares and then finding themselves, you know, kind of a middle, sort of the unexpected addict. The only silver lining in her story is that, you know, because of the prescription drug epidemic, I think the whole healthcare field is now recognizing addiction as a disease, or beginning to recognize addiction as a disease. Before it was, you know, the heroin addict on the street corner who doesn't have anything to do with me. And now we have to acknowledge that these are our patients and that we contributed to the problem. And so because of that, again, the one silver lining in all of this, and it's the only one, is that I do think people in the medical profession are beginning to recognize the problem of addiction and to try to you know, improve treatments around addiction.
Alan writes, I've been using OxyContin for 7 years for severe chronic back pain resulting from, I can't pronounce what follows, but it's something involving the spine and stenosis. Without it, I would be in such pain as to render me immobile, even suicidal. Taking it only as directed, I can function mentally and physically to a degree that would otherwise be impossible. The limiting factor is not a result of the medication, but the back pain itself. If I overdo physical activity, it would be interesting to compare how much good such medications do as compared to the harm. Unfortunately, we do not see typically such stories in the mass media. Erin Marie Daly, I'm wondering if you can just talk about the fact that beyond anecdotal stories to the positive and the negative, there are numbers that talk about these drugs being prescribed in unprecedented amounts to huge numbers of people across California and the country.
Well, as you said before, you know, I don't think that anyone could argue that we have an undersupply of these drugs. I think, you know, it's really interesting to hear the callers. You know, you have Martin and Marla, and both of their stories show that we have a really broken system here. Martin shouldn't be in pain, and Marla shouldn't be addicted. So, you know, I think even there's many ways to approach that problem, and I think, you know, California is taking a lot of steps in the right direction. But just as a journalist, when I was talking to people, when I was just trying to get the stories of people and what are the real life effects that this is having on kids, what's happening is that they're addicted to pills and they're turning to heroin. That's the bottom line. And they're dying because of it. So, and the other aspect of that is that the families are so ashamed that this is happening that no one wants to talk about it. It was shocking to me when I started doing my research, how many people this had happened to. I thought it was just an isolated case of my brother. This is happening to so many people. And everyone I talk to and tell them I've written this book, it's about my brother, every single person that I've told this to says, oh, I know somebody this happened to, or they know somebody who knows somebody that it happened to. I mean, this is happening. And that's just, you know, it's the truth of what's happening.
Dr. Gugelman, I'm thinking of a recent report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In some ways, California comes out well compared to other states because doctors in California wrote 57 prescriptions for drugs like OxyContin and Vicodin for every 100 people. That's in 2012, you know, compared to, say, 12 states that had a prescription rate of at least 100 for every 100 people.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think California actually has done quite a good job with this. We can tell from the two callers that we just heard from that there are still significant shortcomings, and I think that we still have a lot more work to do in terms of both controlling the prescription opioid death, controlling the treatment of patients who have become addicts either to prescription opioids or to heroin or any other substitute that they've been able to find. I mean, I think the gratifying part of all of this is the fact that Florida has actually managed to change their practices so drastically. So the same MMWR report from July of this year actually had a second report about Florida and how their prescription opioid deaths decreased pretty significantly. And the deaths due to oxycodone alone decreased by 52% after the implementation of a prescription drug monitoring program, which is what we're talking about, this central database of all prescriptions, and a couple of other interventions that they had. I mean, I think the really important thing to keep in mind is that the incidence of pain is not increasing. So we have data from 2000 to 2010 that shows that there was no significant change in the proportion of pain-related visits to doctors' offices. But at the same time, there was an almost doubling of opioid prescribing. And that's what, you know, there still are so many pieces of this puzzle that aren't clear, but part of the interaction with your patient where it's you have a medication that you can prescribe so quickly and so easily really has become the go-to now, where really what we need to have is more resources for addiction and pain control, other interventions, psychiatric and psychological interventions as well, which right now in California are more readily available than in other states, but still are very much under-resourced.
And I imagine on the flip side, it's a very uncomfortable and lengthy conversation when you as a doctor say to somebody, I'm not going to give you the opioids you want.
Absolutely. Every time. So every time that I interact with a patient and I give them this information and tell them that this is a risky thing to do and that it is not doing them any good to prescribe them more of these medications, it is a hard conversation and a long conversation and difficult on both sides. And I think, you know, I really appreciate the fact that one of our earlier callers said, you know, we need to listen to the patient. Absolutely, we need to listen to the patient. But at the same time, this is one of the scenarios where listening to the patient can end up killing the patient or causing significant adverse problems. You know, and the previous caller who was going to different pharmacies and getting her prescriptions filled at different pharmacies is a perfect example. Listening to the patient in that case is listening to the patient's addicted brain asking for more medication and just giving in. And that is where our vow to do no harm should trump our desire to offer a quick fix.
Erin Marie Daly?
Just a really quick add-on point. Florida is such an interesting case because it was at one time the epicenter of pill abuse. And
the throughput for much of the rest of the nation's problem with spare pills.
Sure. Yeah, there was a huge pipeline that was established coming out of Florida. And I spent a lot of time there doing research for my book. As the doctor just mentioned, pill deaths down in Florida are very much down. But I just want to mention as well that heroin deaths were up 45% between 2006 and 2010. So we're starting to see the after effects.
Yep.
Let's take another call. Jeannie in Glen Ellen.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question I'd like your guest to address concerning the use of Suboxone, which my understanding is used like methadone for addicts of people who are addicted to painkillers. I have a family member who was treated in a residential program for opioid addiction many, many years ago, and she's been on Suboxone since then, and it seems to me that it is just as bad in terms of the effects on her life as the Vicodin was.
Dr. Googleman, do you want to take that one on?
Yeah, I mean, I think the concern with both Suboxone and methadone, so Suboxone is another long-acting opiate that is formulated with the antidote, with naloxone, to keep people from abusing it IV intravenously. The problem with both of these is that they have, in this country, become a replacement for pain control. So instead of using them appropriately to wean people off of an addicting substance like heroin or prescription opiates, patients are just placed on them chronically. And while there are some patients that this is effective for, there are many, many more that we see who have escalating doses of methadone or escalating doses of Suboxone, and with all of the concomitant adverse effects, constipation, increased falls, all different kinds of other adverse effects that are associated with them. So I think this is another area that needs more research and really more education about, because just to administer Suboxone or methadone instead of prescribing large amounts of prescription opiates is not a solution. It is a perpetuation of the problem. And the combination of these medications with cognitive behavioral therapy and biofeedback and other psychological and psychiatric interventions is really one of the few proven modalities to actually address an individual's addiction.
I'd like just to interject.
Yes, Professor Lemke.
I guess I have a little bit of a difference of opinion. I think that there's an enormous amount of data. I know that there's an enormous amount of data with methadone, as well as Suboxone being prescribed for opioid addiction and being very beneficial for a lot of people. I know there was that article in the New York Times recently that was basically, you know, a kind of an expose of Suboxone. And certainly if you're opioid naive, Suboxone is an opioid and it's abusable. But in many more instances, it's very effective for the treatment of opioid addiction and much preferable to the short-acting opioids for people who are addicted to opioids. And there's enormous data that shows that it improves quality of life. It can even help with chronic pain, and that opioid-addicted persons do much, much better, decreased hepatitis transmission, decreased HIV transmission. That
yes.
really is one of the facts about the treatment of
Thank
opioid
you, addiction. Professor Lemke. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for questions and answers. Continue the conversation online at kqed.org/forum. I want to thank our guests, Professor Anna Lemke, Dr. Hallam Gugelman, and Erin Marie Daly, journalist and author of Generation RX. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, and Vinnie Tong. Our engineer is Howie Gelman. We get online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Rachel Miro, and this is Forum on KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.